all so much for coming in after another full day. I appreciate you being here, and I'm looking forward to sharing some poems with you. I just have to say at the outset that I am so grateful to once again be at Holden, and I'm trying to get this thing back in my pocket. I'm not really going to fiddle with the back of my jeans the whole night. Okay, there we go. That's what pockets are for. We'll just use it there. I'm just delighted to be back in the village. And being here is changing my writing in ways that I'm still discovering. So thank you for that as well. So I'm going to read for about 35 minutes, which for those of you watching the clock and thinking about ice cream means that you will still have a chance to get ice cream after this. It's open till 9, right?
Yeah.
Okay, so poetry is not going to stand in the way of ice cream. So I think, like everyone who has read and been influenced by Toni Morrison's work, it is deeply sad to know that she is not with us anymore. It just happens that since March, I have had a quote by Toni Morrison taped to the front of the notebook you might have seen me carrying around all week. So what I would like to do is acknowledge and honor her by reading that quote. It's actually the conclusion of a piece that she wrote late in 2004, shortly after George W. Bush was reelected, and it was reprinted in the magazine The Nation in 2015. She was recounting how she had had a phone call with a friend, and she was in a state of despair. This is the conclusion of the piece, and it's in a sense a recapitulation of the advice that her friend gave her over the phone. Mm-hmm. This is precisely the time when artists go to work. Mm-hmm. There is no time for despair, no place for self-pity, no need for silence, no room for fear. We speak, we write, we do language. That is how civilizations heal. I know the world is bruised and bleeding, and though it is important not to ignore its pain, it is also critical to refuse to succumb to its malevolence. Like failure, chaos contains information that can lead to knowledge and even wisdom, like art. So she kept finding the words, speaking, writing, and doing language, and her words will continue to be part of how we heal. So my reading tonight is going to be in two parts. The first part is going to be reading just a little bit from Every Dress a Decision, which, as Sharon said, is in the Holden Bookstore. I just have to acknowledge also that Jim and Karen Bodine are in Holden Village and in the audience tonight, and they founded Blue Begonia Press and ran it for 20 plus years, publishing a diverse array of voices, and then handed the press on in great health to Dan and Amy Peters, who published my book in 2011. So as you can imagine, particularly in the United States, publishing poetry is a labor of love. Mm-hmm. So I thank you for that labor of love. So, three poems from this book. This first one is called The Permanent Fragility of Meaning, and that title is a quote taken from the book by Jacques Attali, the book Noise. The Permanent Fragility of Meaning. Why persist, scratching across the white field, row after row? Why repeat the ritual every morning, asking for a new prayer to fold and unfold? Nothing changes. No one is saved. I walk into the day, hands still empty, and beg to be of use to someone. I lay down in the dark and beg to believe when the voice comes again, with its commands, its promises. Unfold your hands. Revelation is not a fruit you pluck from trees. This is the work. Cultivating the smallest shoot, readying your tongue to shape the sacred names your mouth already filling. I lie down in the dark. I rise up and begin again. And this poem begins with an epigraph, a quote from the poet W.S. Merwin, who said, "Humans, a brief and strange species." Humans. The day begins in disarray. You ought, you should, you must, you must, you must, you must. The bees will not be stilled. What stitches mind to body? Who cues the unraveling? If it's true, we're infused with something not found in doorknob, bird, or bee. Why am I confused about all the important things? Crows trampling the power lines from house to house. They don't care who runs the world. I gape at the sky, color of sunflower, color of blood. The world is not as I have believed it to be. I find no vantage, no long view across even the surface. Peristalsis propels the worm into darkness. Electricity animates the lamp. The leaf drinks at the top of the tree. I understand none of the beautiful things. The sparrow bathes in dirt. I don't know why. The birds do not ask themselves or each other, how are we to live? They do not ask us to love them. Oh, the flies have arrived. My personal goal is not to swallow any flies.
That's a good
goal. One last poem from this book, The Girl Who Goes Alone. Here's the thing about being a girl and wanting to play outside. All the grown-ups grind it into you from the get-go. Girls outside aren't safe. That guy in the car, if he rolls down the window and leans his head out, run. Because the best you can hope for is a catcall. And at worst, you'll wind up with your face on the side of a milk carton. Even when you're a grown-up girl, your father, because he loves you, will send you a 4-page article about how to protect yourself while standing at the ATM, while jogging solo, an article informing you how to distinguish phony police and avoid purse snatchers, pickpockets, rapists, and thugs. Tell someone you're going into the woods alone, and they'll story your head with trailside cougar attacks, cave-dwelling misogynists, lightning strikes, forest fires, flash floods, and psychopaths with a sixth sense for a woman alone in a tent. To be a girl alone in a tent is to know that if something goes wrong, you pick the trailhead where the axe murderer lurks, or the valley of girl-eating gophers. If you don't come home intact, the morning will be mixed with I told you so's from everybody whose idea of camping involves an RV or a Motel 6. The message is clear. Girls must be chaperoned. So when, at the end of the day, you zip up the tent and lie back in your sleeping bag, fleece jacket bundled into a lumpy pillow under your head, the second you close your eyes, every least night noise is instantly magnified. You lie there, listening, running a mental inventory of any potentially scented item. Did everyone make it into the food bag hung from a tree? Toothpaste, trail mix, chapstick, sunscreen. Fuck, sunscreen's still in your pack, nestled right beside you, where outdoor men used to sleep. So you're up, out of the tent, headlamp casting its too bright spotlight, darkening the dark outside its reach as you lower the bag, shove the sunscreen in, hoist and tie. Far enough from the ground to elude the bears, far enough along the branch to thwart raccoons, tree far enough from the tent to keep from signaling the proximity of ground level, girl-shaped snacks. You go alone, in part, to prove that though outdoor man has left you, his body is the only geography he can deprive you of. He can give his muscled calves and thighs, his shoulders, chest, and hands to another woman, but not the Sauk River old growth, the snowfields of Rainier, the sea stacks of Shy Shy. He can keep you from the sweet, blood-thrilling hum of his body, but not the sweaty, blood-thumping pleasure of a hard-earned panoramic view or high-altitude starlight. The thing about being a girl who goes alone, who goes again and again, is that it freaks the potential next boyfriend. He doesn't want to be out machoed, and he doesn't want to admit it, and he hopes you can't tell. The thing about being a girl who still goes alone is that it proves you don't need him, and no matter how you show him you want him, it's not the same, and you both know it. Zipped back into the tent, you remind yourself, you've never been in danger. When have you ever been in danger? Well, there was that boy, but years ago, a teenager like you, driving around bored and pissed at the world, a BB gun and his father's two rifles on the seat beside him. Lucky you, the gun he leveled on the window ledge lodged nothing more than a BB in your thigh. The thing about being a girl alone in the woods is you know too much about the grain of truth in the warnings. Even if you seem impervious, weird, good luck leaving you so far unscathed, you know the other girl's stories. Your sister, date raped after a party in college, a friend raped by a stranger at knife point, the two women killed on the Pinnacle Lake Trail, the singer killed by coyotes in Nova Scotia. The thing about being a girl who goes alone is that you feel like you shouldn't go if you're afraid. If you go, it should mean that you're not afraid, that you're never afraid. Your friends will think that you go unafraid. This girl who goes alone is always afraid. Always negotiating to keep the voices in her head at a manageable pitch of hysteria. I go, knowing that there will be a moment, maybe long moments, maybe hours of them, maybe the whole trip, when I curse myself for going alone, when I lie in the tent and all I am is fear. But I walk into the wilderness because the animal in me needs to fill her nose with the scent of stone and lichen, ocean salt and pine forest warming in early sun. I walk into the wilderness alone so I can hear myself, so I can feel real to myself. The girl who goes alone claims for herself the Madrona, juniper, daybreak. She claims hemlock, prairie falcon, nightfall. She claims nurse love, sea star, glacial moraine, huckleberry, trillium, salal, snow melt, avalanche lily, waterfall, bird song, limestone, granite, moonlight, schist, cirque, saddle, summit, ocean. She claims the curve of the earth. The girl who goes alone says with her body, the world is worth the risk.
I'm sorry I'm leaving. I'm going out to my tent alone.
Sleep well, friend. All right, so that's every dress a decision. I am working on a new manuscript. If you were here in February, you heard me read from a manuscript I was calling States of Emergency. This is not a different book, it's the same book with a different title. Poets do that. It's now called Calling Out the Names. So here is that a sampling of that new manuscript in progress. And the first poem from it that I'll read for you opens with an epigraph, a Chinese proverb. The beginning of wisdom is in getting things by their right name. And the poem is untitled. Ear, nose, eye. We teach every child to point and name. The child goes to school, learns he is the norm, she the grammatical variant. When the place between her legs is left unnamed, what lesson does the child absorb but that what she discovers there doesn't quite exist except to be washed, face averted? Eventually she'll gather the desiccated Latinates, the language and labels of diagnosis and prohibition, a linguistic burka rooted in pudere, be ashamed. She'll catch the juvenile slang, the metaphors of confused fascination, geographic euphemisms, might as well call it Australia, quarter of a million words, but not one with the raw authority, the accurate, forgive me, mouth feel of the thing itself, so taboo as to be nameless, that place all human aching starts. That final line, that place all human aching starts, is borrowed from Lee Young Lee from his poem Self-Help for Fellow Refugees. Dear Whirligig, how many summer afternoons found you at this lakeshore, unable to account for your fate? You want what is only possible with stillness. You have yet to learn the names of nearly everything you love. These tiny birds in the yellowing lilac, branch to branch in search of what? Who are they? Each winter, you earn the next summer's light until, not yet, it arrives unannounced, your last. From the corner of an eye, you'll see, not yet, how perfect and brief your body was, how even one afternoon of lake water and sunlight, this girl child splashing in the shallows, the laughter carried from a far shore, how even this was enough. Seen from the diminishing vista of a rear-view mirror. I am, of course, inspired and enlivened by all of the sessions this week and all of the conversation, and I'm just so nourished by it. And I found myself in the session that Glenn Jordan was leading this morning, giving us a very close reading of the Book of Ruth. I found myself thinking of this Bible story that I remember hearing in my youth, and it has lingered with me as an adult in a somewhat imperfect way, as you will hear. It's a poem in two parts, which means a poem in two voices, and the title is also the first line. I remember the bruise blooming on her perfect skin, her body marred for the first time by Yahweh himself, a blemish to spare her from the sacrifice to other gods, a girl like you or me otherwise. Who was she? Why does her story, told in, what, an after-school special, a religion class film strip? Why is it the mark and not her name, or whatever he required of her next, whether she birthed a king, prophesied, or redeemed her tribe? Why is what lingers all these years later the mottled shadow on her arm? And what was it the story intended to teach us? That he loved her enough to claim her as his own? Or is the lesson the price of divine favor, the weight of the Lord's hand on a girl's body? I had no blotch, had not yet bled. No man knew my body, though I saw the hunger in my neighbor's eyes, in his son's. I tell you, I was unspoiled until the very moment the priests came to take me to the altar. I was proud to be the one chosen to trade my body for rain. My death would feed the tribe. The Israelite God had no right to me, but laid his thumbprint on my arm. No one asked what I wanted. When one God marks you, all the other gods become blind to you. How to interrogate an archangel. Offer firewood. Strike up a flame. You won't get anything out of him while he's shivering. What you want is the statuesque gesture of confidence, the clarity derived from a place at the deity's right hand. Keep the coercion to a minimum when wrestling with a spiritually disheveled higher being. Your position can sour, leaving you with nothing but pine needles in your hands. Ask the most urgent questions first. Why are armies, and is it malignant, and who keeps tabs on the status of the platypus? Remember, information is secondary to your purpose. The voice matters most. That melody can repair all the torn pages. But first you have to recognize what you've caught in your own human hands on an ordinary city street in the middle of March. So yesterday I taught a workshop on ekphrastic poetry, on poetry written in response to works of art, and I read one of my ekphrastic poems there, and this is a second. This one was prompted by meditating on a photograph by William Albert Allard. It's a photograph called Madison Grove Resort, Little Floyd Lake, 1995. And the photo is a landscape of sorts with several tween girls playing in the shallows of a lake. And it's called Sisters Swimming. All afternoon, the lake kept their childhood intact. Let them float, the heat no threat in the lake's embrace. Dusk now. And the day mirrors her body on the brink, as if she's heard her name called in a voice that won't be ignored. She stands knee-deep, roused to the shift in atmosphere. When did her body shed the childish softness her sisters still wear, like the oversized t-shirts that protect them from the sun? The air newly cool against her limbs, a set of tools sharpening themselves for uses she has yet to imagine. Her gaze now interior, as if the summons arises from her own rectangular torso, unfamiliar and auspicious, like a chapter written in a bold hand. This will be her last lakeside summer. Soon she'll walk to shore, wrap herself in a towel, and close her arms around the secret authority of her body, with each gesture traveling miles from her sisters. This is a poem in brief sections. I'll just pause very briefly between them. Dear, excuse me, I wasn't a fly, it was just a water. I think. Dear America, wildfire ash revises the skyline again, and with each inhalation, something like a rumor of war flares in our chests. Today, we can't even be sure of the air. Last night, white boys with tiki torches encircled the Charlottesville synagogue with a noose of Nazi slogans I'd assumed unsayable in 21st century America. A man shot his car into the protesters. A man shot his car into the counter-protesters. I watch my neighbor mow his lawn as if this is a normal day. Grass to cut and bag, haul to the curb for someone else to carry away. Or maybe like me, he's doing the one thing he can manage under the weight of such questions. How many? How close the fires? Dear America, again this year, the news is like a door I can't help pushing open, though invasion best describes the feeling flooding in. Dear America, let us name the amputations. Let us count the slips toward war. Dear America, it's not enough while history throbs to write an honest account of weather, no matter how the peonies raise their fists. Democracy isn't, after all, evergreen. Dear America, today I want to fold and box, set alight every aching gob of news this week unleashed. Climb into bed with my head empty, my husband and I alone with hours to school each other on all the hinges our hooked limbs might open. But amassed behind my eyebrows are the 1,963 reasons the ocean is warming, and that's not even counting hypoxia season. Yet, I still got up, drank coffee, in the smallest of habits took refuge, lined up the pairs of shoes by the door, held the rail as I walked down the stairs. Shall not be infringed. We dove under a table, my bag clutched in one hand, your hand in the other. House rules, no politics. Who had slipped, left the door unbounced this summer night? He fired, pointing first at the other end of the room, shed one weapon for another. Is that how we had time to dive? We threw our bodies down like cast-off shoes, like trash. This happened. It happens. It will happen again. Maybe to me, maybe to you, waking. Down he went, through each room in my house of sleep, attic to basement, shooting out the lamps, making permanent the dark. Deciduous. Days like today, I could let it all go. Release ambition like a balloon floating into someone else's yard. Let the radio keep its death toll in speeches. I will give myself to what will answer with blossom and fruit. Could I die back? Could I be mere twigs waiting? I ask for light, rain, a piece of ground. Here I might remember the prayer of silence, practice one thing until done well, heal what lies within reach. So I have been immensely fortunate for the past 22 years now to work at Seattle Children's Hospital. I've spoken with a number of you over the last couple of days about what I do there. In one job, I write and edit clinical content for the hospital's website. And then in another role, I work with staff support doing poetry and reflective writing sessions for the hospital staff. And these are called Read, Write, Release. Mm-hmm. And they're designed to help staff stay connected to their own hearts. A few years ago, I was asked by the chaplain to write a poem for the hospital's annual memorial service for children who have died. And the poem I wrote was integrated into the part of the service where families are invited to call out the names of children they have lost. And families come back year after year for this communal ritual of remembrance. And parents, siblings, grandparents, and doctors, nurses, other providers call out name after name. But we all, of course, need moments of collective ritual to remember those we love and still miss. And I'm mindful of that, particularly this week, as we try from afar to wrap our heads around, to absorb in our hearts the terrible losses in Dayton and El Paso, and as I mentioned earlier, of Toni Morrison's passing. And so, before drawing this evening together to a close, what I would like to do is read that poem that I wrote for Children's Hospital, and when the poem is done, I would just invite you to call out the names of your beloveds. And so together we'll bring them into the village, into our community, by just calling out their names. Stripped of leaves, each limb exposed, maple remembers the whoosh of branches, lush with wind and shade. Even frozen solid or emptied by drought, river remembers flood banks, the pulse of current. Grain in the loaf remembers field. Scar remembers knife, but also suture and the hand that bandaged. Bed recalls absent sleeper, damp breath on the pillow. Brush stilled on the dresser remembers knots and what followed the untangling. Honey remembers hive, bee, and blossom. Salmon tastes home in the sweet scent of its birth stream. Sand remembers shell, gravel the granite cliff. Lung, breath, throat, song, and I remember you.
Jennifer.
Betsy.
Paul and Ethan.
Richard.
Emmett.
Lee.
John and Helen.
Close with one brief poem to send us out into the night. Thank you for being here with me. I appreciate your focus and your generosity. This is called Eve Walks the Highway at Dusk. I want to be visible for my safety, yes, but also for yours. And so in my palm, I carry a small light, and I let it bump against my leg as my arm swings its small arcs in the dark.